This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
First of all, I just want to say welcome. We have Lynn Cruz, actor, producer, and many other tasks on the film. Miguel Coyula, writer, director, producer, et cetera, et cetera. Kylie Acosta from the Spanish department here at UCSB, and I'm Christina Venegas in Film and Media Studies. And I just want to welcome both of you back, Miguel and Lynn. It's really, really a pleasure, and I know how hard it is to come to Santa Barbara because it is far from different airlines. So perhaps going off of this clip, there's so many questions that this uncomfortable film brings up, you know, and it does put you in an uncomfortable position in so many ways. And I feel you're running to catch up to the next thought or the previous thought. It's you're constantly kind of refocusing from moment to moment. But in a recent essay, Miguel, you said that in Corazón Azul, past and present take turns suggesting the impossibility of a new future. And I think we could possibly agree that this feeling is deeply conveyed in the film. And it really embraces this harsh physical, social, psychological environment. So I want to talk a little bit more about how you get us into that atmosphere. You know, you suggest it in terms of lighting, but, you know, say a little bit more about how this is working in the film.
Yes, the idea was also that in terms of environment, it will be there will be a sense of pollution that will be permanent almost throughout the film in the shape of the oil refineries, or there is a hint of a nuclear accident as well, acid rain. Mm-hmm. So, and through the newsreels and the television newscasts, you get a sense of that world that surrounds the characters as well. And that world is very fragmented, and it wasn't originally like this. I first wrote the script in 2004, and it was a much more linear script. In that script, Tomás, David's father, he was a photojournalist who gradually discovers that his son and then many other people were genetically manipulated. But when I started shooting the film, which was in 2011, I had already done other films that were more fragmented in narrative terms, and this story started to feel more archaic in a way. For me. But then something happened, and that is the actor who plays David's dad, Tomás. He left the movie, and I was paralyzed for about 2 or 3 months. I didn't know how to continue, but, and even though he told me we can do another scene to explain what happened to the character, after much thinking, I decided I'm not going to explain it. And I'm gonna leave that narrative uncertainty as a strategy throughout the film. Mm-hmm. In the sense that first you will think that he's going to be the protagonist, then it seems like David is going to be the protagonist, and then eventually Selena. But even those three stories are constantly bombarded and sabotaged, mm-hmm. with elements from in the shape of different genres, different formats, mm-hmm. Throughout the film. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take turns asking questions. Just so we're
doing. Go ahead. Right. So thank you both for being here. It's truly an honor and an incredible experience to have been able to watch this film. This is actually the first time that I've watched it on the big screen, which is a completely different experience for me for many reasons. And I really this really disrupted the expectations that I think I've become used to having just as a spectator or as a viewer or a consumer of cultural production in general, in the sense that I think that I was expecting to be sort of lulled along and being maybe spoon-fed elements of a narrative that I could make sense of and that wouldn't be too difficult the first time I watched the film, and I realized that that wasn't gonna happen. And so at some point I sort of had to abandon that expectation and realize that this is more of a visceral experience. This is almost an embodied experience to sort of just take in the film, let it wash over you, sort of contemplate what's coming at you, and also experience, for me at least, experience the film more as like a moving piece of artwork or something that has so much texture, detail, sound, little elements of sound that sort of highlight aspects of what I'm seeing visually. And so as I was experiencing the film in that way, there were just some questions that came to mind for both of you in terms of the creative process. So one of those questions was, I was wondering if you could just discuss the use of color in the film, the very poetic use of color that I feel that this film has. Color, the negative space, the negative imaging, other aspects of the visual imagery that we see, you know, maybe close-ups of certain bugs, different camera angles, elements of nature, dripping water. There's just so much to take in. And I was wondering, in terms of your process, are these images that come to you ahead of time that are very strong, that maybe you say, okay, I have this visual image and I'm going to record this, or I'm going to write it down and then recreate it? Or are some of these images that happen spontaneously and then are just sort of, integrated into the film structure?
It's a combination of both. I mean, many of these images come from dreams, and others, I just stumble upon them, locations that might have an element of interest, but then because we don't have physical control of the location, they need to be modified. Filming in Havana can be problematic because there's such a big gamma of colors, but not the ones that I necessarily need for a specific atmosphere in the film. So the idea was to have a blue, gray, violet, never green, and red only in these moments of intimacy, which are related to my character, Caso Número Uno, when he makes the politician go into himself, into this inner world. Fire emerges also in the cave. Those are moments that are, but basically when they go into this subjectiveness, as in the case of Elena when she hypnotizes her mother, the space dematerializes behind them. And that's an effect that I saw first on a cartoon we saw in Cuba from 1977 called Voltes 5. And Japanese cartoons, I saw it there, I saw it then in other two animes. Whenever there will be a dramatic moment, the background will fade to black. And it was something that as a kid had a very strong impact on me in a sensorial way. And that actually a lot of, subconsciously, my first film school were Japanese anime. Because they never had huge budgets like Disney to animate 24 frames per second. So many times the visual design and the editing and the composition was very striking to me.
Yeah, it's so economical, but it's so powerful as well. And I think it really requires the spectator to actively be watching and actively be doing a lot of the work in this film, because you need to use your own imagination to imagine what is, you know, behind or what is in this negative space. So in that sense, it was just a completely unique experience.
But the idea was also the fact that I wanted to convey that the island or this world was a ground that was not fertile. And that's why the idea of this pregnancy that is 20 years long and doesn't get to evolve in a way or be released. She cannot have this baby. And it's never really explained. This is just one of my interpretations. That's the one I work with, but that doesn't necessarily have to be what other people interpret. But the idea was that basically these characters were emotionally mutilated during their childhood, even though the film doesn't really show it. And there is an element of autism in them, in that sense.
Yes, thank you so much. And is the blue and the red stood out to me so strongly. I felt that they were rich and unusual hues of blue and red, and all I could think of too was just the Cuban flag and those colors. And I was wondering if that was intentional or if that was just something that my mind landed on.
In that particular moment, no. Because I always think of colors in terms of the emotions they provoke on me. But of course, when you work with so many of them and you put it together after so many scenes, after so many years working in the film, because what's interesting is that I will finish a scene. We will shoot in chronological order. But I will finish a scene, and then maybe 2 years later, I will find that if I add this shot here, it connects better with a scene later on. So a lot of ways, words about planting seeds, and you don't necessarily watch that seed grow, but little by little, maybe in 20 minutes or 30 minutes later in the film, you see it evolve. For example, when the neighbor knocks at the door and offers Elena a guava marmalade, towards the end of the film, the mom also, her mom also offers her a guava marmalade. So all the, but all these elements are distant enough so that the connection is not obvious. And also, for example, Elena's detective work about finding where her mother is minimized because I didn't want to dwell on moments that were not that interesting. And I wanted to have more time with sensorial elements, like when she's tasting the guava marmalade. And to recreate a childhood that is not within the frame of the film, but sensorially could take you back to another place. Right. And actually, the mother's name is Eugenia, which is a reference to a Cuban novel from 1919 by Eduardo Urzaiz, which is also about the same subject matter. Actually, the cover of the novel has this monster coming out of a of a woman.
Very interesting. So, Lynn, the two of you started working on this 2011, 2012. And, you know, you've alluded to the making of this film over 10 years, which seems incredible. I mean, yes, of course this happens, but, you know, the way in which you're doing this is actually pretty remarkable. But that period of time also inspired you to write a novel, and Empire inspired you to write a novel too. So they're making the film and writing novels, but your novel, Crónica Azul, is about the making of the film as well, about the experiences related to this. And so I do want to talk about the experience of working clandestinely, but also, and just as Kylie was mentioning, all the references. But some of these things are events that occurred. You make reference to that. Mm-hmm. And so you're out in the street, you're shooting candidates without permits, you're making stuff up in, you know, in hallways very quickly. How do you orchestrate this? It feels like it needs a lot of choreography. And I know you were not just helping on the film, two people on the set, but you're also acting in the film.
So the biggest challenge to me was, of course, to be an actor, since I was producer, assistant director, costume designer, and yeah, we have a lot of, as Miguel was saying, explaining at the video, what we didn't have on budget, we dedicated with time. And it was the biggest, ¿cómo decir? Como el mejor patrimonio que teníamos era el tiempo.
The best resource that we had.
So, when
was time? Sorry, yeah, it's time.
When I was producer and or assistant director, it was easier. But in the moment when I had to play Elena, was the most difficult experience. Because Miguel used to demand on the set, of course, we were just two people most of the time. Please, there is something at, in the back. Can you remove that or do this? And I had to remind him, please, today I'm Elena. I'm not the producer anymore. I'm not the assistant director because I have to be focused on my character. And it was the biggest challenge to me in the film. And also because, for example, in the scene with the mother was very complex in many, in different ways. Because we were very, very far from Havana. It's Hershey is the name of the town. It's in the middle between two provinces, Havana and Matanzas. And we had to drive 40 minutes every time that we went there. And I remember a day when I forgot the ring. Oh. And when we were close to the location, I said, oh, Miguel, we can't do anything today because I forgot the ring. And we were crazy, and Miguel said, okay, we are going to be there, we are going to see the plan, and then we are going to decide what's going to happen because we are here. We cannot lose the gas, the everything we spend in the travel. So yeah, we had to change everything, and at the end we got the shots, details, and something like that.
The other thing that made it very difficult was the fact that I wasn't repeating the same camera angle, and when we were shooting outdoors, since I wanted cloudy days or the magic hour, that meant that, for example, that scene when the girl cuts the belly of the guy who's killing the tree, it's only 2 minutes long, but it took us 6 days because we could only shoot 20 minutes at a time. And
And is there a lot of harassment in terms of, you know, people telling you can't be here, asking for a permit if they notice that you're filming?
In that scene, yes, it was. There was a school nearby, and the school principal thought we were filming the school, and immediately they came to ask what we were doing. But we got really lucky because the actor who plays the tree killer is a very well-known television actor. And so we told him we were doing publicity against the killing of trees. And she thought it was okay because he's well known. So that's one of the advantages of having a well-known actor. People tend to think that it's okay. But technically, we didn't have that much problems because most of the times we were only two people. And we were quick enough, 20 minutes or no more than 20 minutes, even though if we had to go several days, but no more than 20 minutes at the time.
Yeah. So the scene in the building, which is a long scene, and that building is very significant in all of your work and in a few pieces of your it's a building that pops up again and again. I want to talk more about that scene. I mean, there are moments in that scene where, I mean, especially as you're talking about the dreams, we're going into the bowels of the building and kind of losing ourselves in the building, and it's terrifying, and at the same time you feel like the building is going to collapse any minute, you know, it's like there's all this anticipation and this disorientation inside the building.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, yes, because the idea was that the character will eventually enter another level of consciousness. And so the idea was to present the building as a labyrinth in that sense, even though it isn't. I mean, it's a very large building, but its structure is not precisely labyrinthic. We spent 4 months shooting that scene. And precisely because I had filmed in that building before three times, a short film, two short films, a medium-length film and a short film, and we actually wanted to film inside the abandoned nuclear power plant. And I digitally joined them together so that they would be close in the space of the film, but they're actually in different provinces. So when we couldn't get inside the power plant, I said, well, we're going to have to go back to the building once again. How do I make it different? And the building had a lot of great elements for production design. It's just that there were different floors and different elements were combined, sometimes within one single shot, to make the building different and look different and get that sense of disoriented. There's a moment where he peeks through the window after we see him walking in the background, which provides the idea that he has been going around the building probably. And the idea was to build it up until he goes to the penthouse, and that's where he finds Elena. But the idea was to use sound as much as possible and to create sounds that were not within the frames of the screen, but that were happening on the left channel of the screen or the right channel of the screen in order to provide as much texture as possible. All that was dubbed in the garage. I was doing the footsteps and the breathing of the character because we had lost the actor. We no longer had him. As a matter of fact, Lynn also played him. When you see her feet, the character's feet passing by, it's Lynn wearing three sets of pants so that the legs will be thicker. And also my mom played him in the reverse, wearing the jacket. I myself also on the camera was filming in some days by itself as I was acting with Ling. I couldn't see my face. That was also very tricky when we were acting together because the camera was filming by itself in the last scene. And that meant placing it 100 meters away and then run and do the scene and then come back so that nobody would steal the camera, check the footage to see if it was right, if I didn't stand in front of her. So that scene also took a long time. We weren't there about 10 times.
Well, watching it now, knowing the whole history, because, I mean, he's an important actor. Mm. And he's the actor that leaves. And he just disappears, you know, he unexplained, but yes, we assume something terrible has happened.
Yeah.
But then it makes sense in the way that we lose ourselves inside that building, and then that's where he ends up disappearing. I mean, it makes sense narratively in retrospect how you did it.
And that was interesting because when he told me we could do a scene to explain it, I thought that since the structure of the film was about branching possible interpretations for the audience, and that one branching wouldn't necessarily contradict the other, that's why I was doing title cards all the time on how one interpretation could build and wouldn't necessarily betray another. So for me, I tried to leave it open that maybe Elena killed him, or maybe the state security put him in prison or killed him. And then the investigation that he was doing in the first version of the script is almost complete in this version, and it's in the computer that the state security agents tries to get to, but then we see Elena reading the computer, and we see a list of voluntary mothers for this project, and we see, and it's very small because these elements don't appear big in screen, but you see Eugenia as one of the, Lynn's characters. And then when she goes to visit the gynecologist, which we saw in the earlier scene in the film, she identifies herself as Eugenia, which is the name of her mother. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, 30 minutes later in the film, when we see the mother, we find out that she's named Eugenia. But the first time you see the film, probably you won't notice these things because of the sensorial experience. Mm-hmm. But that was the biggest challenge for me, was to build the structure of the screenplay with all these little cues so that I wouldn't be missing anything, but still give more space for the sensorial experience.
So one of the questions that I had for both of you was, since you know this is a censored film in Cuba, have Cuban audiences had a chance to view this film in any way, and what does that look like? And if so, has it, in your observations, been received differently by Cubans of different generations who have experienced, you know, life on the island and revolution in markedly different ways?
Yeah, we have been doing that since we premiered in April 2021 at the Moscow International Film Festival. And since then, we have been doing private screenings at home every Sunday for groups of between 10 or 20 people. And we gathered, we already filled the Cinematheque twice, which is the largest in those 2 years. It's been complicated because the film is really designed for a large screen, and on a television screen you lose a lot of the imagery and the sound design. Still, what was interesting is there was a girl that came over and she said that the film provoked her a very strange feeling because she said it's really sunny and hot outside, but my heart feels like the movie.
And the biggest audience we had in Cuba, in Havana, was at the Norwegian embassy, because they were sponsors, and at the, it was a little complicated to get the invitation for this. They have it's a room, not a movie theater. It's a
screening, like a screening room.
It's an open theater,
open air. Like an amphitheater.
How do you call it? Yeah, exactly.
For 200 people, and it was a very special moment. Because it was last year in November, it's been a year from that experience, and there were many different people, and it was very special how they react to all the details that we thought it was just for people who love cinema or who understand cinema, and we were wrong, because the reaction were very close to what we were trying to say with the character or with the film that Miguel was doing. And it was a shame that Miguel wasn't in Havana at that moment. But yeah, it was the only opportunity. It's complicated because in the traditional industry, there are many people working for the audience, for the message, and they are they know what they are doing in terms of the audience. But since Miguel was creating, or he used to create his films in this particular way, we discover or we find the audience later, and mm-hmm. you can and it's a very it's different in the different with the different audience. It's a new film for us.
But even generationally, when we premiered in Moscow at the mm-hmm. Moscow International Film Festival, there was a generational gap. People that were more our generation or older, they had a strong connection with the idea of building this mm-hmm. utopian right. new man. But for people that were in their 20s, their questions and comments were more towards transhumanism. And for them, Fidel Castro was like a mad scientist who created an experiment, Frankenstein, who went wrong. And mm-hmm. But beyond that, they were not that, mm-hmm. they didn't have that particular tie to Cuba mm-hmm. or to that context. But they still were very interested in the movie. It's just very different approaches. There was mm-hmm. a woman who was crying in the audience with the scene with the mother, and she was our age, more or less. We could never really talk to her and see what that scene triggered in her, but we would have really liked to.
Yeah, but it's interesting yeah. because what we felt in Moscow, of course, because we had a very big audience there, was similar than we were feeling with the rest of the Cuban audience. Mm. In different ways, but for example, the youngest generation in Cuba, they didn't care about the political subject matter either. They were talking about they connect themselves with the generic manipulating character, mm-hmm. the main characters. And this was revealing in a way because we are living the same process, no? Mm-hmm. In a way.
And that was interesting because in terms of acting styles, these characters who are emotionally mutilated have a different way of speaking, which is colder, more detached. Mm-hmm. Their pacing is slower and versus mm-hmm. normal people in the film, which are more spontaneous. But it was very clear for me that I didn't want to turn these characters into heroes or make them sympathetic because I always think it would be an easy solution to have good and bad guys. And I always try to look for contradictions. Mm-hmm. So when they blow up the hotel, they do something terrible where innocent people die. And that to me was more interesting to basically structure the lives of these characters who have a different set of ethics mm-hmm. that were developed in the last 60 years of the Cuban Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Some of you have videos, just for anybody who's interested, there are videos online of the discussions of some of those home screenings, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which are quite telling to listen to. Some of them are pretty long, but it's mm-hmm. also so fascinating to be able to do that and patient on your part, right, to be doing this year after year, having these discussions, and I'm assuming that every discussion bring something new, but that it also brings the film to you in a different way every single time you screen it.
Yes, it's interesting because there are people that have come back to see the movie 3 or 4 months after and they ask me if I change anything in the movie. And I say, no, you just focused on a different element because it depends on what you saw the previous right. week or the mm-hmm. previous day or what you lived through. The film will be perceived differently.
Yeah. So maybe because of a reference you made, I mean, also, you know, the question of filming in the way that you do, you're an independent filmmaker, but you've also made some very strong and very specific statements about what independence means to you, mm-hmm. which isn't the same as what it means to others. And mm-hmm. And then in 2019, I believe, the Cuban government, there was a decree that declared that finally independent artists could be registered and then have some sort of amparo, some sort of support from the state. And what was your reaction to that?
Well, that decree had a lot of positive things, like independent filmmakers could now do co-productions and receive money from other countries, from producers who were willing to invest. But there was one chapter which was really problematic for me that said that the content of these films had to be within the liberties allowed by the Cuban Revolution, which could be interpreted as whatever they wanted to interpret. And I didn't sign for that decree. I know most filmmakers signed for it, but and the thing is, before, independent films were in a sort of legal limbo. And but to me, it's important about, I mean, none of my films could have been made if I had signed this, and that's like extending your hands to put the handcuffs. Once it's on paper in black and white, then they can have your film. Because that means having the script reviewed. And the only way was to have to achieve complete freedom was to simply be outside of any radar and continue working the way I did before. Because it's complicated when you talk about independent films in Cuba. It's certainly there are filmmakers that have more independence, but the minute you have ties with the Cuban industry, your content is somehow limited, even if a lot of people won't want to admit it. But you cannot have the picture of Fidel Castro that is negative and have it approved. It's just not going to happen, just to mention something extreme. But healthcare, corruption in the healthcare, in the education system, there are things schools, you cannot show on film in Cuba, just to mention a few. And to be independent is to be independent in form and content, as I said, not just the fact that you finance it from your pocket.
Yeah, so the question that I have is very lofty, so I'm not expecting an answer here, but I just love to hear your thoughts. I mean, with so many restrictions, but also this culture of sort of celebrating the arts and valuing the arts, I would say in Cuba, maybe in a sense, in a very different way, I guess, than they're seen in the U.S., for example. What would you say is the role of art in Cuba? Because there just seem to be so many contradictory and conflicting and nuanced narratives.
I don't know. I mean, to me, it really has more to do with putting my dreams and my subconscious on the screen before anything. And then you rationalize, if it helps society in any ways, great. But that's not really what moves me to create a film. It's just an accumulation of images and sequences that then, of course, they're put together, but they respond more to intuition when they're being created. And then the rationalization comes when you join all these pieces together. But I do think that art has to be uncomfortable. Otherwise, it becomes an escapist experience, and that's not what I'm interested in film. An audience needs to be challenged. Those are the films that really interest me when I was a kid. And when I was a teenager, that was an interesting experience. When I was a kid, they would show Japanese animation. Many times they were not for small kids, and I would be traumatized when I would go to the theaters, but they left a strong impression in me. And when I was a teenager, the films that really caught my attention are those that kept going in my mind, even after the credits roll. So those are the kind of films I try to make, in a sense. Yeah.
What is the role of the political figures in the film?
That was a very tricky choice, because for a long time, since I was creating this stylized reality, I felt, but at the same time, it was a challenge, that if I include real-world figures, that will clash with the most unreal construct of the film. But then I thought, it's a challenge, I'm going to do it. And so instead of creating a representation of reality, it's more like a uchronia. How do you say it?
Uchronia.
And a space where things might have evolved differently, but still there's all these world figures, political figures there. But the idea was that it's impossible, at least for my generation, to trust any politician. That's how I feel. My films are political because of that, because of my denying of politicians in general. And that has created me trouble not only in Cuba, but also my films not play at the Havana Film Festival. They haven't played ever at the Miami Film Festival. A big deal of the Cuban American community think I'm a communist, that we have been called a communist. And that's great, because it's really what a teacher of mine said once at the film school: when you do a film that is dealing with a political matter, always make sure you upset everybody that's involved in a conflict. Otherwise, you end up making propaganda for one of them.
Yeah, it really speaks to the fact, too, that everybody brings such a different reading to the same film, that Miami Cuban community could see it as its communist film, and that's how they're labeling you. And now in Cuba, you know, you're censored, contra-revolucionario. It's almost funny, dare I say. Uncomfortable, but
well, the film was also banned in Belarus and Morocco. We were invited to the Minsk International Film Festival, and 3 days before, I get an email from their programmer saying that Lukashenko's commission had declared the film was pornography and it could not be shown. And one day later, he says it's okay that it will be shown. And I said, well, okay, they bought me the ticket. So I arrived there, and when I arrived, they had taken the film out of the main competition and placed it in the new filmmaker section. And I was 44. I didn't fit there. But when I go to the website, they changed the age limit for being a young filmmaker to 45. And when I get to the theater, there was just five strong guys in the front row and nobody else in the audience. And that was it. Yeah, it's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'd like to open it up to folks in the audience.
I usually speak very loud, so it's okay.
We were recording.
Hello. No, well, this has been really a great pleasure and a real special moment for me to see this film. I finally got to Havana several years ago, and I was intrigued about the building. I thought, is that one of the buildings that were built by the Soviet Union because those buildings apparently didn't last too long because they made it with the wrong material or something?
No, that building actually was built 3 years before the triumph of the Cuban Revolution. It's from 1956, but it was occupied after the revolution by a lot of technicians from the Soviet Union and Eastern countries started to live there, and they left after the collapse of the Soviet Union. That coincided with a hurricane that came to Cuba and left the building in that state that is still today like this.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I too was... very moved by the film. But my reaction as a Cuban American, it's neither political nor artistic. And I guess because my sense is that the film is actually a documentary. There are so many codes that Cuban would pick up, for example, the fact that there are actors there who are very well-known figures, like Fernando Perez and Tania Bruguera, etc. So the entire discussion concerning politics, and particularly the reaction of Cubans to the film, make me wonder, or make me imagine, what it would have been like for this film to have been produced and actually made 20 years ago. 20 years ago, probably you would be in jail after making a film like this. But today it seems as if criticism of the actual state of things in Cuba is not as polemical as it was two decades ago. And I think that, to me, it's instructive about, on the one hand, the power of your film, and on the other, the lack of, let's say, more censorship or more reaction on the part of the powers that be in Cuba towards your film. I don't know, I'm intrigued by that.
It's interesting. Yes, and censorship and people that are in jail right now in Cuba are activists and journalists. Those are where the government go with their full force. And during the making of this film, many actors left the movie, so we had a lot of collateral damage. A friend of ours, for example, a photographer, went to take pictures of one of the scenes when we were shooting the last scene, and he was summoned for an interrogation by the state security, which he recorded with a hidden cell phone. and they basically told him to walk away from us, that we were not artists, that we were sponsored by the CIA. And that's when we discovered a lot of people had walked away from our lives that probably lived a similar experience, but they wouldn't tell us. The problem really comes when we try to screen the film and we advertise it on the social media. We had a police raid with our previous film because we posted on Facebook we were going to do a screening, and for the Cuban government to have a large group of people in one place is a problem. And that's where they really go after you with their full force.
I also became censored. I used to work with the Cuban film industry in theater, and in 2018, since 2018, I cannot work as an actress anymore in any, even the independence or in the institutions. No, I didn't receive a phone call anymore for a casting. We don't exist in the island. It's the way that they control, they control us, no?
But what you mentioned about 20 years ago, also 20 years ago, probably the film would have not been possible to get made because the technology for digital independent, it was not there. Before, everything was controlled by ICAIC, the Cuban film industry. I mean, there were digital cameras, but not to the extent that you could do a production like this in terms of technology. So, yeah, the two things go, it was a development of the times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there was a hand up here.
Could you talk a little bit about the decision to kind of not show as much of like the graphic violence that you could have, like when the guy gets his throat slit, like you cut away right when it happens, but then to show a lot of sexually explicit content that like a lot of other films wouldn't show?
Well, precisely because of what I said before, the kind of I want to see on screen something I haven't seen, and I see a lot of violence in many genre films, and it's overdone, but then the sexual content is toned down. And to me, the sexual content in this film, especially in the explicit sex scene, was a way to convey that these characters who were had this autistic element, it was the way they connected through this sexuality that is so explicit and at the same time ominous in a sense, because to me it was a ritual of initiation for David. After David has this experience, he defies the dean of the college and he basically breaks away from society. The next time we see him, he's already part of this band. And that's an ellipsis that the film uses a lot. And one of the things that when you work on it for so long, you start to check out and you don't even film some scenes that you think because were important because they're no longer important. I didn't want to show him arriving to the cave and being introduced to anybody. That wasn't that interesting. I just wanted to see him there and as part of that collective experience, which then gets dismantled, by the way, because my character, by the SS, we are all different. And basically, everybody's on their own now, which is a comment also on politics in Cuba now, where everybody wants to be a leader and their ego is so big. And sometimes that goes against the very much against the movement and the causes they're trying to defend.
Mm-hmm. So I want to add something.
Yeah.
On the other hand, sex is the only freedom that that Cubans had during the revolution. So in a way, Blue Heart, to me, is talking about freedom. It's not just about freedom, but also is one of the important thing by the character to the characters.
Muchas gracias por la película. Me parece no tengo ni adjetivos porque es como muy potente, ¿no? Y los felicito por el coraje. I'm just saying that thank you for the film. I think it's very powerful, and you're very courageous, both of you and all, everybody who's involved in this. So in part, you answered my question, one of my questions. I have like three. And one is very simple, is the title. Since the title of a piece of art is very important in your own film, and I think it was like a very powerful, also part of the film, the title of the, this portrait, or, you know. And the other question is, yes, because I don't know where it comes from. It's not evident for me, the Corazón Azul, right? And the other is about, you spoke more than once now about mutilated, emotionally mutilated people. And that's like, even saying that is super strong. Maybe I when I was seeing more feelings. Like when the guy cries, David cries, or, you know, I saw feelings. So my overall analysis or impression, rather, of the film is it was not about emotionally mutilated people, because I saw emotions, even though they are, as you say, mutilated, but I maybe saw more the emotions than just the idea of a mutilated, although that's probably the objective of the sect or whatever, right? They ended up swallowing both of them. But even in the moment of the death, well, the moment of the mother, and you and Lena, it's like I felt there was some emotions, very strong emotions there in this scene, even though you explain it's hypnotized. But, you know, this is a transformation of emotions. And then the final comment is more of a comment on the sexual freedom, because it was only heterosexual freedom, right? It was not other kind of sexualities or sex in Cuba in those times. As long as it's heterosexual freedom, it was probably freedom, but we know what happened with homosexuals in Cuba, so maybe that freedom was also limited.
So the title, I'm going to tell you what it means for me. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but blue, of course, for me is sadness. And I wanted to have a difference in the four characters that appear genetically manipulated in the film, and that is that my character, who is the oldest, sort of accepts the violent nature of his violent nature, but Elena is in a way questioning her actions, and that's why she wants to go back and retrace her steps to her childhood. Whether the younger ones, David and Diana, the girl with the machete, they are living the adrenaline of self-discovery, and they can be really tremendously cruel. At some point, actually, what the state security agents comment that my character started undergoing all these mutations during puberty. So it's hinted at, and that's another ellipsis in the film, when we see the anime cartoon that arms grow from her, and then we see the girl who's Fernando Perez's daughter, or she already has arms, although they're covered by these black gloves, but it's another ellipsis in the film. And blue, to me, refers to the sadness of Elena, who ends up being the protagonist of the film, in the sense that she cannot really escape her destiny. At some point, when she discovers who her father is, she takes off the ring, but at the end, she puts it back, and it's not clear whether it's an acceptance or a challenge, because she really struggles to put the ring back on. I could make a list of all the things I had in mind, but it would be really long. But sexual freedom in the case of these two characters just happen to be heterosexual, but it was not trying to comment on anything else. Yeah.
No, because ironically, the persecution in Cuba, in other countries from the communism world, it was more to remove the differences than the sexual preferences in a way, because there was not just against the homosexual. Even there were heterosexual that the governments called them homosexual, but because they didn't like what they were talking about in theater or movies, and also the Jehovah Witnesses, they were persecuted at that time. So what I'm trying to say is that in Cuba, it's not a big deal if a professor has an affair with a student, for example, or if the people, because we had to go to the countryside to be there, far away from the family, nobody cares about what we were doing at that school. It's what I felt when I was doing my character in this scene, because it's violent what she's doing with him, because she's older than him. And in a way, if you forget that they are genetically manipulating, it's just a woman, an older woman with a young boy, and she's very aggressive with him, and yeah, and I was thinking in this on this all experience that were violent even to me when I was in the ¿cómo se dice? At the high school. I was in beca, ¿cómo se dice?
Scholarship?
Yeah, no, it's not.
But they were the schools in the countryside.
Exactly.
So they were funded schools by
wasn't in the countryside, I was in the city, but yeah, still it was far away from my family,
yeah,
and I was just 15 years old. And I felt myself violent, mm-hmm, because of that. I didn't like to be there, and
yeah,
I had to,
yeah,
to do it, otherwise I couldn't go to the,
right,
to the university.
Yeah.
I had no choice. Even my parents, they didn't like, but they have nothing to do.
You know, when what you were talking about with the emotions, and maybe I'll just close with this unless somebody else has a question, but Fernando Pérez, I wrote down here, I didn't want to forget to ask. Fernando Pérez is a filmmaker and who's very supportive of artistic freedom and has taught at schools, but has always also carved his own way in working within the system, but you know, made very unique films. And then here he's playing the psychologist, and it's very interesting in that moment. I mean, it's very interesting to watch his performance. It's really fascinating to me to watch his performance. I feel like I'm just talking to him. You know, he's so genuine.
Mm-hmm.
And I even thought, did he write his lines? Or were there ever even any lines? Is that really how he feels? You know, because they're the things that he's saying are could very easily come, mm-hmm, out of his mouth, right? But there's a, and then he says, you know, that you have to let the child be, and that, you know, the child has this inner world.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this is part of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of your own inner world, but part of what the movie's doing. It's like, mm-hmm, this kind of circulation of these inner worlds and these inner energies and these inner emotions. But he conveys an enormous amount of emotion in his toned down performance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very, he's incredible.
He was so good that I wrote another scene for him. His character grew. But that was very interesting because and I love actors who can improvise. Not all actors can do that. But Fernando suggested lines, and I always like the actors to provide extra lines to make each voice different throughout the film. I also work like that with the actor who plays the dean. And that's really what makes every character different. In the semi-documentary, fake documentary as well. I use many different techniques. For example, for the reactions to the assault of the Cuban television, sometimes I will just show the speech of my character to the people and then record their reactions. And a lot of interesting things came out that way. In other cases, I had a line planted and they have to improvise until they will get to that line, that key line of dialogue. And in other cases, it was completely written. So there were many different techniques used throughout the film. Yeah.
Hi, really enjoyed the film. I have like kind of two questions. How did you as a writer come up with genetic manipulation to kind of express how the Cuban Revolution affected the Cuban people? And how did you stitch together the shot where it's kind of from Elena's POV and she's watching the TV and you see her hands, you see kind of the reflection of her?
Well, the first one, this actually comes from a novel I wrote in 1999 called Mar Rojo, Mar Azul. But I always felt that Fidel Castro was like a mad scientist in the sense that he was experimenting always with a cow that would produce the best meat and the best milk, or the hydroponic tomatoes. So he was always, and he will pour all the resources of the country for this particular experiment, then he will drop it and he will go to another. So I thought if he had the technology to actually do it with humans, he could have done it probably. And that's when where the idea came about. But the other shot you mentioned, which one is it? It's on the television, a reflection?
Yeah, it's from her POV, and then you see a reflection. So her hands are in it, and then you also see her reflection in the TV.
But she's drinking
Right. Then I shot the reflection, and then I shot the television screen. I did the scene twice. But also there is a, there was a tricky shot, and that's the one in the mirror where she removes her hair in front of the mirror in the mother's house. That was tricky, of course, because if you film the mirror from the front, you see the camera. So I had to shoot the mirror and then shoot from the perspective of the mirror what the mirror would be reflecting, which in this case would be Elena. And then I filmed her against a white screen and then cut it out and added so that it would seem more subjective, the point of view. But yeah, there's a reflections all throughout the film. Some are more evident than others. The state security agents that appear in the film are also appear as a reflection, because I thought the state security can see you, but you don't necessarily see what they're planning behind closed doors. So they see the security cameras and they see you, but you cannot really see them.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.